Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now. The interior minister of Syria has been found dead just days ahead of a potentially damaging report from the United Nations. Syria's official news agency says Brigadier General Ghazi Kanan committed suicide in his office. The general is one of several high-ranking Syrian officials who may be implicated in the assassination last year of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Joining us on the line is Rami Khoury, editor-at-large of the Beirut-based newspaper The Daily Star. Rami, what do you make of this news?
Well, it's quite a shock, obviously. I don't think it's totally unexpected. I mean, nobody could have predicted a suicide, but certainly there was a lot of pressure on the people in the Syrian security establishment. Some of them had been interviewed already by the UN prosecutor, Melis. There's a lot of speculation about how far up the chain of command in Syria the accusations might go related to the Hariri murder. So there's a lot of diplomatic pressure on Syria, and so it's not totally surprising. The only real question is, did he commit suicide? Was he made to commit suicide, or was he possibly murdered? And there's a lot of speculation already. This only happened a few hours ago, and there's a lot of speculation already in Lebanon and Syria about possible explanations for this.
Mm-hmm. Because, as you said, he might have known too much, and this might go too high. But you said, you know, who could have seen this or something to that effect? And apparently the general gave a radio interview in Lebanon just hours before his death, saying something along the lines of, "This is my final declaration." This is after he denied taking money from Hariri or wanting to kill him. Was he potentially, I mean, I'm sure people are going to be listening to that radio interview a lot closer.
Yes, what he actually said is that this may be my last comment on this, and he was replying to press reports in Beirut claiming that he had been in cahoots with Hariri, who was making lots of money in Lebanon when he was in charge of the Syrian security system in Lebanon, but he obviously seems to have decided to take his life from these reports.
Right.
The speculation, there's really two stories going around Syria and Beirut now. One is that he was killed because he knew too much and the people didn't want him to spill the beans. The other story already circulating is that possibly he was killed because he may have emerged as the only credible alternative to Bashar al-Assad, being an Alawite, being an old hand in the regime, knowing everything about the security services, having been in the intelligence and having now been Minister of Interior. So he was strategically placed and has been having been in this business for like 35 years. So that's another rumor. So there's a lot of speculation going on now, or he might just have killed himself because he saw that the noose was tightening around him.
Ghazi Kanan, as you said, was a Syria's intelligence chief for two decades. He essentially was the ruler of Lebanon as well, correct?
Well, essentially, yes. I mean, the Syrians controlled all the strings, economic, political. They manipulated the system any way they wanted. They redid election laws. They handpicked the president. They extended the president's term last year in a very unpopular move. And this is why there was such a spontaneous uprising against them. People in Lebanon had just gotten fed up with this overbearing Syrian presence, even though the Syrians for the first 10 years in Lebanon really did an important task in stabilizing the country and ending the war and helping the country rebuild, and people appreciate that, but 30 years is just sort of 20 years too long.
Rami Khoury, you mentioned Syrian President Bashar Assad. If, in fact, his interior minister killed himself, and if, in fact, it had something to do with the murder in Lebanon, what does this mean for the president of Syria, for the region? What are some of the ramifications, potential ramifications?
Well, the ramifications, I think, are extremely significant. On the Syrian level, here you have the interior minister of one of the sort of toughest security states in the Arab world killing himself because the noose was tightening around him through an international investigation. What this means is that the security services around the Arab world, who have ruled most of the Arab world for the last 40, 50 years, are reaching the point where they can no longer act with impunity. They are starting to be held accountable by their own people, by other countries in the region, by the world system, the UN, and powers abroad. So this is an incredibly important development. It's not just this death of this one man, but what's been going on in the last 4 or 5 months with the four top Lebanese security chiefs now in jail and being sent to trial. This is an incredibly important moment in the Arab world where, if it works well, the Arab people can hope to have a future where they're not run by police states anymore.
Rami Khoury, syndicated political columnist and editor-at-large of the Beirut-based newspaper, The Daily Star. Rami, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And now, a few minutes on child rearing. This week, the American Academy of Pediatrics issued new guidelines on how to reduce sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, the mysterious, heartbreaking ailment that kills about 2,500 infants in the U.S. every year. The Academy's most controversial recommendations are for parents to stop sleeping in the same bed as their baby and give their infant a pacifier at bedtime. Well, this new thinking does have at least one critic, and we're going to hear from him, but parents take these guidelines seriously because in the mid-90s, when the panel told parents to put babies to sleep on their backs instead of their stomachs, the number of SIDS deaths were cut in half. Well, joining us on the line is Dr. John Katwinkle of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. He chaired the panel that came up with the new guidelines. Dr. Katwinkle, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And can you review for us these main recommendations that your group is making to prevent SIDS? The first one seems simpler to understand, the recommendation not to sleep with infants in the bed. Is that because of a fear of suffocation?
There are now over 10 case-control studies showing an increased risk if parents bed share with their baby during sleep.
What happens in those studies?
Well, the SIDS risk was significantly higher than if they did not bed share. Now, it was even worse if they were sleeping with an infant on a couch, or a sofa of some sort. But really, just bed sharing in general, it was significantly increased. But I think the very positive point about it is that several of those studies also showed that if you room share but not bed share, in other words, have the bassinet or the crib in the same room as the adult, there was a decreased risk of SIDS.
Well, as you know, Doctor, there's been some criticism of the recommendations, and this is always a hot topic of discussion among parents. One of your critics is on the line with us. He's James McKenna, director of the Mother-Baby Behavioral Sleep Lab at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana, and I want to bring Dr. McKenna in. Dr. McKenna, we just heard Dr. Katwinkle say that they have 10 independent studies showing that
yes.
SIDS is higher in cases where parents are sleeping with a child either in a bed or on a couch. So why isn't it a good recommendation for parents not to do this?
Well, certainly babies sleeping on a couch, there's no question but that that's very dangerous. And one of my difficulties with the studies, as Dr. Katwinkle knows, is the quality of the data. The evidence is only as good as the classification of variables. And many of these studies really don't use the same definition of bed sharing, and the factors that make bed sharing dangerous are not always acknowledged or recognized.
What do you mean by that? In other words, it may be that the baby is sleeping in a way that would cause a problem even if the baby was in a crib?
Yes. Let me give you an example of the way in which there's a double standard used. When a baby dies sleeping prone in a crib, the cause of the death is said to have been from sleeping prone and is likely SIDS. When that same baby is said to have found or was found to have died in a bed, the cause of the death is said to have been bed sharing, and the solution to the problem is to eliminate the practice rather than to eliminate the factor that actually caused the death.
Dr. Katwinkle, let me ask you about that. There is criticism that bed sharing may be taking the blame for other things. For instance, the babies may have been on their stomachs. Did your data look for that?
Well, I think it's a little misleading to say that it's my data. I mean, our task force is did not do independent research in this, although there actually were two members of the task force that did. But our task force was really charged with examining other people's data. The studies were very carefully done, some obviously better than others, but really very high-quality studies, and they had a very careful multivariate analysis to try and rule out those confounders, which, of course, are always a problem with any epidemiologic studies, is that you have to rule out the confounders.
Well, Dr. McKenna, I'm wondering if even one baby's life is saved because parents don't bed share with the baby because of this recommendation. Isn't that worth it?
I think that's a really unfair thing, way to put it. What if I said to you how many babies might have been saved had they been sleeping next to their mothers? their mothers or dads might have responded or detected a cue or a signal, etc.
Well, I want to ask you about that. Why do you believe that bed sharing should be considered?
The usual explanation given by parents who in many cases never expect a bed share is that they get more sleep, that they're able to breastfeed more easily, that mom's milk supply comes in more quickly and is more efficient. The contention has been that by classifying all bed sharing as being the same, all unsafe, it makes it very difficult for any parent to learn how to maximize safety and make that choice for themselves.
Well, Dr. Katwinkle, what is the problem that arises when someone bed shares with a child? Can you tell that from your research?
There are a lot of hazards in an adult bed, such as pillows and loose bedding and adults that...
And big elbows and...
Yeah. Right, exactly. And we really challenged the investigators to show some evidence that indeed bed sharing can be done safely. And there are case after case after case of babies that have clearly died in an adult bed.
Dr. McKenna, we understand that you fear that these guidelines could possibly be used in custody battles?
Yes, well, it's already been done even before this recent recommendation, and this has huge legal implications. I know of families have been questioned for already supposedly practicing an unsafe, potentially child abuse, child neglect form of child care, which is bed sharing. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be quite unacceptable, and I worry about the legal protections now that they might indeed be subject to interrogation or prosecution by Child Protective Services.
I'm in complete agreement with Dr. McKenna that this is something that requires education of the public and the courts, that these are risk factors that we're describing. They're not clear causes, etiologic causes of the death. And if inappropriate prosecutions occur, we need to defend against that.
Right. This is not law you're setting, but guidelines.
This is not law. These are guidelines, and they're based purely on epidemiologic observation.
In the time that we have, though, I just want to make sure we've touched on the other recommendation, Dr. Katwinkle. You recommend as well that pacifiers be used to prevent SIDS. Why would that work?
Another bit of controversial recommendation, you're right. Now here there are six studies that have shown pacifier reduction in SIDS. There's been speculation that pacifier use at the time a baby's going to bed, it may change the infant's state so that he doesn't sleep quite as deeply, perhaps.
And as you know, there are critics of this guideline as well. Breastfeeding advocates are worried that encouraging pacifier use is going to lead to a decline in mothers breastfeeding their infants.
We considered that, and we looked at that very carefully, and we feel that if a breastfeeding baby doesn't use a pacifier for the time that breastfeeding is becoming established during a relatively low risk for SIDS period, the first month of life, the evidence is not very strong for a risk of interfering with breastfeeding during that second to sixth month of age.
Dr. John Katwinkle of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, who chaired the panel that came up with the new guidelines to prevent sudden infant death syndrome. Dr. James McKenna is director of the Mother-Baby Behavioral Sleep Lab at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And this program note for you, at the later in the program, we're going to take a look at an issue at the other end of life. We'll hear from a former White House bioethicist who opposes living wills. But first, up next, a check-in in Pakistan. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Military helicopters are taking advantage of clear skies in Pakistan today to resume desperately needed drops of food and medical supplies. This after aid was temporarily halted due to yesterday's heavy rains and hail. The delivery of supplies is no easy task. Steep mountain roads, many of them damaged by the quake and landslides, are impassable to most vehicles. Today's reports list the death toll in Pakistan between 35 and 40,000. In the Indian portion of Kashmir, it's at least 1,300. Laura Winter is covering the region for the Christian Science Monitor. She visited the Muzaffarabad region of Pakistan at the epicenter of the quake earlier today and joins us now. Laura, what did you see?
As we got into Muzaffarabad, from above you can just see how many houses have just sort of toppled over. And what's interesting now, as opposed to a few days ago, is that there are actual tent cities now springing up next to the homes. So there is some aid getting there. Tents are getting there. People are getting some shelter. There just isn't quite enough to go around yet.
What did you see on the ground?
On the ground, at the two places that we landed at, we saw lots of injured people. They were on the sides, either under tents or on cots, ready to come towards the helicopter. When we went off to the university, there were a few injured, but what really sort of struck me there was the absolute smell of the place. The university was full of college students when the earthquake struck, and a lot of those students were buried underneath the rubble, and their bodies had not been recovered. So when you land there, unfortunately, you smell them. They're really not looking through the rubble of the university, and when you land, as you're descending down, you don't really know it's a university unless you ask, because it just looks like a bunch of broken rocks on the ground.
We heard from a college professor earlier this week who said that it's tradition for students to stand when a professor enters the room, so they actually were standing at the moment in his classroom. He was able to step back and get out of the earthquake, but they all died. Are there rescue efforts still going on? We've heard of a dramatic rescue of a child pulled from the rubble, but is it now switching to a recovery effort at this point? Can you tell?
Well, rescue efforts are still ongoing. It's just not as large as it could be, let's say. What happened this morning was that the Russian team that came on board the Chinook that I was able to get on, they were two parts. The first part was to set up a field hospital, and the second part was search and rescue.
We've heard conflicting stories about just who is providing aid. Early reports out of the region said that the Islamic militant separatists in Kashmir were providing the lion's share of the aid, and they said they hoped it would improve their political capital. These are the groups that have been outlawed by Pakistan and are fighting Indians. But today's Wall Street Journal says the quake actually decimated militant groups. What are you hearing?
Well, what I'm hearing is that it's very difficult to tell because there are so many people up there. There are moderate Islamic groups that are also going up there. There are groups that are not affiliated with any sort of religion, but that are also just going up there and taking up trucks full of food and tents and blankets. So it's really hard to tell whether the Islamic movements for separatism are actually, you know, doing the lion's share of work or if they're just saying this. But what is happening is that there are definitely aid groups getting in there from about 22 different countries. This is happening not as quickly as is needed.
From your observation, is that just because it's such a horrendous area to reach, or is this government inefficiency? What's your sense of that?
My sense that it's really a combination of both. We are talking about the Himalayas. These are the tallest mountains in the world. And to even grasp the idea that there are 51,000 people injured up there, how do you get them out? And that is exactly what the Pakistan government is facing right now. They need helicopters, they need more trucks, they need more support, and they need to organize it. It's just a very overwhelming task, which I think even most nations in the world, even the richest and most organized, would have a hard time coping with.
How many injured did you take out on your helicopters?
We took out 30 on the helicopter that I was on and another 30 on the other one. But what was so sad is that when our helicopter was full, we had 30 injured people on board, there was still a long line of people with broken bones and concussions trying to get on board to try and get medical attention. And they had to be turned away. There just wasn't room.
You were traveling with the U.S. military. What did they say about aid efforts?
They're really focusing on transportation. They see transportation as the absolute key to saving lives. At the moment, General Eikenberry, who I spoke to earlier today, told me that he's actually looking for helicopters in Europe and also in the United States to be sent over to Pakistan. Right now, there are helicopters here. There are eight Army helicopters, but they have to go back to Afghanistan because they have a different mission. Their mission is to support Enduring Freedom, which is the fight against terrorism. As soon as the new helicopters come, they're going to go back to Afghanistan. So he's looking for ways to get more transportation here to facilitate the process while also taking care of the mission in Afghanistan.
Laura Winter is covering Pakistan for the Christian Science Monitor. She's speaking to us from Islamabad after making a trip today to the epicenter of the earthquake. Laura, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
And this note about Iraq. Violence in the run-up to Saturday's constitutional vote continues. Today, a suicide bomber killed 30 Iraqis at an army recruiting center at the western town of Tal Afar. A suicide bomber struck the same town yesterday. Also, lawmakers announced a last-minute compromise designed to satisfy Sunni concerns about the constitution. Lawmakers have been called back to Baghdad to vote on the revisions, a last-minute compromise to gain Sunni support on the draft constitution. President Jalal Talabani says there is no excuse for Arab Sunnis to boycott the vote now that we have responded to all of their demands and suggestions. We'll have more on Iraq tomorrow with journalist Anne Novat, who spent months sleeping in the homes of Iraqis, talking to average citizens, finding out how they feel about the new Iraq. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. Dr. Leon Cass, who chaired President Bush's Council on Bioethics through controversies over stem cell research, cloning, and reproductive technologies, resigned his post earlier this month. For the record, Dr. Cass's stance was in line with the president's on many of those issues, but he has said he didn't want the debate over stem cells to be the only mark of his tenure, and before he left, he published a report called Taking Care, Ethical Caregiving in Our Aging Society. Dr. Cass is now at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute in Washington, and he joins us now. Dr. Cass, you write that this report is intended to help Americans think about how they will die and who will care for them when they do. But you also point out this is a wonderful time to grow old, with earlier retirements, better health care. So what's the problem?
First, one should begin with the good news. Thanks to advances in public health, in medicine, and in healthy lifestyles, Americans are living healthier and longer than ever before. What's been not sufficiently remarked on is while this is a blessed time to be old, the price that many of us are paying for this increased longevity is that eventually, after a healthy decade, say between 65 and 75, as many as 40% of us are going to pay the price of as long as a decade of enfeeblement, dwindling, debility, and in many cases dementia before we finally die. And that this is, I think, this presents us with a looming crisis of long-term care.
Well, yes, because you write, 20% of Americans in this older population down the road will die of a cancer, 20% of a heart disease. More than 40% of Americans will die after spending 8 or more years struggling with a debilitating illness such as dementia.
Yes, so, this is already the case in a really quite startling study from RAND that presented us with those figures, and it really woke us up that while there's a great deal of emphasis in the public discussion about the importance of healthy aging and shows pictures of seniors playing tennis and enjoying a healthy sex life, and all of that is true and to the good, nevertheless, we should not neglect the fact that there are already millions of American families in which people are struggling not only to care for their young, but also to care for their aging, debilitated, and dwindling parents who can no longer care for themselves. And this is going to be in every household, even if it's not there at the moment.
Well, some of our listeners know it's in mine with my elderly mother, and it is mind-boggling when someone has dementia. Do you understand why there's been what you and others are seeing as an increase in dementia? Is it just because it's an older population?
I think it's primarily because it's an older population. We are now living long enough to be afflicted with the age-related diseases, of which dementia is but one. It's a particularly devastating one because it attacks the human person, his understanding, and decision-making power.
There's also another big concern that you have, and it's ironic because we've been told for a decade now, get a living will, get a living will. You don't like living wills. Why?
Well, we present a very careful and thoroughgoing analysis of living wills, which seems to be our society's preferred remedy for the fears of the of this difficult future.
And let's remind people, a living will is something in which, when you are of sound mind, you say how you want to be treated if you become ill.
Right. There are actually two forms of future directives that we can write when we're healthy. One is to appoint somebody as our proxy when we can no longer make decisions for ourselves. We name a spouse or a child or a friend or someone like that to make decisions on our behalf. The council endorses that practice very strongly. What we have doubts about is the adequacy of the other alternative, which is write down explicit instructions about what you'd like to be done or not done in the event that you can't make these decisions for yourself. And the critique is both practical and philosophical. Practical, people just don't fill them out. They can't possibly be done with the kind of adequate knowledge to know the details of the literally thousands of human situations that one might encounter. The most important thing, I think, is to say that, look, people change. Their circumstances change, their values and interests change, and the most important thing that we face when we have a loved one to care for is to try to do the right thing for that person here and now and not simply to honor wishes expressed 25 years ago. Part of the truth about old age, of which dementia is an especially horrendous presentation, is that old age eventually means the diminishment of our powers, and we come to discover what's been true all along, but our independent culture doesn't generally allow us to recognize, namely, we depend for much of the good things in our life on our friends, our families, our loved ones, on the larger community.
Well, Dr. Cass, I want to ask you about that community because you also speak in your report about assisted suicide and your fears that someone with dementia may not be protected against, you know, forced assisted suicide. Right now, existing laws in the U.S. require that someone be in their right mind to participate in assisted suicide. So why did you feel the need to put this in? Do you fear that a future America would ever consider euthanizing its elderly who have dementia?
One doesn't like to say such things. We are a very decent and compassionate society, and we have learned increasingly in my lifetime to recognize the equal humanity of people with disability, even people with serious disability. On the other hand, if the costs go high, if there are fewer and fewer caregivers, if people begin to develop the view that there are such things as a life not worth living, it will be very easy to somehow come to the conclusion that this patient might in fact be better off dead.
On the other hand, doctor, and listeners may remember this as well, I represent a family that took our mother out of a hospital because we felt that the money and the time that was being spent on treatments that weren't going to do anything were not quality of life for her.
Exactly. And the council, this is on the other side. On the one hand, we strongly believe that you cannot somehow seek the best care for your loved ones if you can always imagine that putting them to death would be the best therapeutic option. On the other hand, we, against the view that everything should possible should always be done, we believe that since the purpose of best care is to serve the life the patient still has and the goodness of that life, we believe that there are all kinds of reasons to forego and even to withdraw existing life-sustaining treatment when these are burdensome to that patient, when they're inefficacious, or when they interfere with the process of a person irretrievably dying.
Essentially, you're trying to get Americans to deal with the idea that they are going to be dependent on people in old age. That's a tough sell, isn't it?
It is a tough sell, and also, I mean, I'm getting of an age myself, and I cared for a mother with Alzheimer's disease for 13 years. This society is, in fact, going to be judged in the future by whether we will have the will and the resources, indeed, to care for one another when we can no longer care for ourselves.
It sounds like you are suggesting a sea change to plan not for independent living when you're older, but also for dependent living.
Exactly right.
Dr. Leon Cass, former chair of the President's Council on Bioethics, speaking to us from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. where he works. Dr. Cass, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Question: would people be less inclined to produce garbage if they were forced to carry it everywhere they went for a week? One professor was determined to find out, so instead of handing out textbooks, he gave students industrial-sized garbage bags. Mark Meisner teaches at the State University of New York's College of Environmental and Forestry Studies. He joins us now from Syracuse, New York. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We're also joined by student Mara Sneden, who was part of the class. Mara, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And I want to start with Professor Meisner. So where did you come up with this idea?
It came to me last spring, and I thought it would be a fun way to embody the consumption issue for the students. But once I decided to do it, I noticed that it's sort of been done in other places.
It reminds me of a popular program in the 90s where high school students had to carry a baby doll around to see what it would be like to be a parent. But in your program, they're carrying their garbage. Let's ask Mara. Mara, how much garbage did you carry during the course of the week? How much did you produce?
I had a little less than a pound, I think.
What?
I really didn't have very much. I found I had more recycling, actually.
Well, how much recycling? Because you had to carry that as well.
Yeah, and I ended up having 2 pounds or over 2 pounds of recycling.
Now, Mara, be honest with me. Did you find yourself sort of limiting what you did so that you wouldn't have to?
Yeah, sometimes I was really conscious of something like going to the bathroom and washing your hands. I wouldn't take a paper towel. I'd either use the dryers or wipe my hands on my pants or something.
Well, speaking of going to the ladies' room, Professor Meisner, I mean, what did they have to carry? Did they have to carry everything? Toilet paper?
No. We definitely didn't want any biological waste or anything associated with bodily fluids, shall we say, in the garbage.
And so what kinds of things did they end up carrying?
A lot of packaging. From food that they bought or things that they bought. We had one student who actually showed up at the weigh-in with a bicycle wheel as well. That was probably the most unusual thing.
Yeah, because there was a weigh-in at the end to find out, and I understand Mara said she had about a pound of garbage, but it went up to almost 13 pounds for some students. Recyclables went up to 15 pounds. Mara, as you were carrying this around, did people ask you, what are you doing?
Yeah, I definitely got a lot of questions and weird looks, but I think that was kind of the idea, was that because people would ask me and then I'd strike up a conversation, and it was a way of getting, making the issue out there and making people aware.
Professor Meisner said that much of the stuff was packaging. What was some of the stuff in your garbage?
Yeah, a lot of packaging. I don't know, I got a package from my mom in the mail and all the wrappings and tape that came with that, and just from food, opening food packages. I mean, those are my primary things that I was putting in my garbage, I think.
But, Professor, if it's largely packaging, CDs come in jewel boxes or cereal comes in a big, cardboard box, that's not something that consumers have any control over, is it?
Well, that's right, exactly. And that's one of the things that came up, in reading students' journals, was that you have no control over this. If you need to buy food, you can't easily control what kind of packaging you get, and it's more of a systemic problem.
Professor, I understand you did the assignment as well.
That's right, I did. Oh. I carried my own garbage and my own recycling, and I even composted, which I was doing anyway.
Oh, no, did you haul that along with you, too?
I didn't haul the compost.
What was your weigh-in?
I had 1.7 pounds of garbage, 10.75 of recycling, and 4 pounds of compost.
And what were some of the things that you had?
Packaging, paper towels. I got a cold right at the start of the assignment, so I had a lot of tissues in there.
That's too bad.
This sort of very typical kind of stuff.
Professor, what did you learn?
It really impressed me how much the students were able to reduce their waste by making this conscious choice. Just the mere fact of having to carry it around caused almost all of them to make choices to not let certain kinds of waste pass through their hands so they wouldn't have to put it in their garbage bag. And it's actually also a little bit deceiving because we can make certain choices. For example, if you go to the store and you buy a shirt and it comes on a hanger, and if you leave that hanger with the store, you're leaving it as their waste rather than taking it home and making it into your waste.
Right.
So we can displace our waste to a certain extent.
Mark Meisner, a professor at the State University of New York in Syracuse, who had his students carry around their garbage for a week to kind of see exactly what kind of flotsam and jetsam they were producing. Mark, thanks for speaking to us about it.
Thank you, Robin.
We also spoke with sophomore Mara Sneden. And the project's over, Mara. Are you sort of missing your garbage?
Not at all, really. But now I'm aware about what I'm consuming, and like, I'm just glad I don't have to put it in the bag anymore.
Mara, thank you as well.
Yeah, thank you.
And stay with us. The horrors of the restaurant kitchen coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. With the rise of the Food Channel and a cornucopia of cookbooks, food memoirs, and even food reality shows, restaurant chefs have become superstars. But as a new book illustrates, disaster is always lurking just behind the swinging kitchen doors. The book is called Don't Try This at Home, a collection of true culinary catastrophes from over 40 of the world's most renowned chefs. Imagine making pea soup for 1,000 for a rainforest fundraiser after a Sting concert, only to find it fermenting because it had not been chilled. And then there's the New Year's Eve, which starts with the chef who's late and ends with guests trying to strangle waiters. But wait, let's ask the man who was there, Anthony Bourdain. He joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York City with more on his contribution to the book Don't Try This at Home. Tony, welcome.
Good to be on the show.
Well, author of Kitchen Confidential, we should remind our listeners that was your book about adventures in the culinary underbelly. So
yep.
you have been on the dark side.
Yes, I guess that's true.
But let's tell your story that you tell in the book. It was back when you were, what, a sous chef, an assistant chef?
Yeah, I was still essentially a cook. And I had a really talented chef. As an administrator, he was not so great. And he got us it was a very expensive special menu for New Year's Eve. We were booked solid at a huge nightclub restaurant, and he did not see fit to share the information, such as menu, preparation, recipes, with his staff until the last possible minute. And, of course, it became, for me, the most humiliating and painful mass meltdown I've ever been part of.
It's unbearable to read, frankly, because, you just can't imagine this can happen. First of all, he's late. He doesn't show up. You're all standing there wondering. It's almost 5 o'clock on New Year's Eve. Half of your colleagues seem to be on drugs waiting to find out what they're supposed to do. When he does show up, as you said, overly ambitious menu. Just if you could just tick off in that kitchen, just a couple of things that were breaking down, including one of the cooks. What were some of the things that were happening that meant the meal didn't get out?
Well, the timing was bad. The appetizers coming off of two different stations, the oysters were taking less time, for instance, than the truffle soup, when the truffle soup was supposed to be baked in a crock with a little puff pastry lid stretched over it. And, of course, when it gets hot and you're busy, it's not time to be trying to stretch puff pastry over crockery. The printer shut off for around 25 minutes, which meant that, we were standing there in the kitchen pumping out orders, blissfully unaware of the fact that, 25 minutes of full tilt, orders were being lost in the system. And so when they finally started coming in, there was this incredible backlog. When you've had nights like this, and I think most chefs and most cooks at one point in their career somewhere along the line have had, a terrible disaster, It haunts you and molds you for the rest of your life. One of the reasons chefs are so maniacal about their mise en place and planning and preparation is the fear that having lived through something like that once, brings to your every waking moment afterwards.
But has it ever broken down this horribly? It got to the point where people who were waiting outside for their food, which was not coming, were trying to strangle waiters. Security guards, who were supposed to be bouncers for the party later, were beating up customers who were trying to leave.
I think the most blood-curdling moment for me was when I turned around and saw all of the waiters standing there absolutely silently. When waiters stop complaining and or even asking for food, it's a bad thing. This was a tough, seasoned group of waiters, and here they were literally hiding in the kitchen, afraid to go out on the floor. And, of course, the nightclub, the bouncers, of whom we had, I think, 23, these are people who were used to, dealing with a pretty rough nightclub disco crowd. They really had kind of on-off buttons, off they're not at work and on they're beating on people. So they didn't bring the kind of diplomacy one might have hoped for to our somewhat tonier crowd, dinner crowd.
Meanwhile, it is New Year's Eve. They've paid, several hundred dollars for this meal, and it had to be reimbursed.
I think they were perfectly within their rights to walk out without, signing, paying the check. But, security, when they see these people heading for the, just bolting for the door, would try to stop them. They'd, of course, they'd been drinking champagne for 2 hours. They'd get confrontational. And next thing you know, it was a mosh pit.
There are other disasters in the book. I love Daniel Boulou's pea soup for 1,000 that doesn't get refrigerated and ferments so badly that it's bubbling out of canisters. He then has to canvass the whole New York area and buy every pea that he can to remake this. How common is that? You know, chefs running out, something's been destroyed and you've got to replace it. Does that really happen?
It happens all the time. And I think, you know, chefs are very, very resourceful people. I mean, it's happened to me. I get a last-minute, you know, party where I need, 600 orders of boned-out poussin, these tiny little birds. I've had to call every poussin farmer in, the East Coast, and they all start, throttling their little birds for me. Most of us are able to reach out at the last moment and fix it. I mean, there's a whole name for it within classic French cooking. It's called System D, and it stands for débrouillard, extricator. It implies a certain sort of sleazy plan B, not as good as plan A, but a way of getting yourself out of a situation or getting through a situation. And I think what one of the notable things about the book is that here you've got all these great chefs overcoming what seems like impossible adversity. And the fact that all of these chefs have that in common points up part of how much a part of the job that is, dealing with the unexpected. Mm. Some of my favorite stories in the book are, Mario Batali, who is still traumatized by this risotto incident that happened years ago when a rather famous British chef throws a hot risotto onto his chest. And Gabrielle Hamilton's story of hiring a blind line cook, I think, is absolutely priceless. It's a very self-deprecating story in which she tries to talk herself into believing that this is going to work out just fine. And, of course, it doesn't. And it's not so much, make fun of the blind guy. It's funny seeing how the kind of torment and the denial that Gabrielle goes through. Some of these stories are legendary. I mean, the Michel Richard story. In fact, he was asked to do his story because people in the industry had been talking about it for 15 years. Let's just say it involves a wedding cake and a couple of dogs. as me or Kimberly Witherspoon, who put together this book, would call around a chef saying, would you like to contribute a story to this book? Again and again, we'd hear, you have to call Michel Richard and ask him, to tell you the wedding cake and doggy story.
I've spent some time in famous kitchens in another life. I was in the Inn at Little Washington when the sous chef there caught on fire. They put him out very politely. That's a very polite kitchen. And at Le Bec Fin in Philadelphia, right before the chef there lost all of his fingers in the Cuisinart.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How often does that happen? I mean, the kitchen can be a very hazardous place.
Well, I mean, you're working around open flame, with sharp knives, lots of alcohol, a frequently marginal bunch of people with fiery tempers and unlovely personal habits. It can be, and you're under incredible pressure. Of course, that is it's astonishing how smoothly most kitchens work and that they're able to create magic every day.
Arthur, TV personality, former chef Anthony Bourdain, is one of the contributors to the new collection, Don't Try This at Home, a book about catastrophe in some of the famous kitchens in the world. Tony, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Don't Try This at Home, Culinary Catastrophes from the World's Greatest Chefs, is edited by Kimberly Witherspoon and Andrew Friedman.
Tugs running to my signal. Baby, take me out. Baby, take me out to eat. How about that?
Or maybe let's stay home. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
I see that scarlet field. Can we put aside our politics for just one meal? Oh, la, la, la. They got free-range potatoes, braised with a mango, garnished with a $20 tomato. Don't care if it's tasted, don't care if it's good.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.